Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to 1A. We'd like to better understand who is listening and how you're using podcasts. Please help us out by completing a short, anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey. That's one word. It takes less than 10 minutes and really helps support the show. That's npr.org/podcastsurvey. One word. Thanks so much and enjoy the show. This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley, broadcasting from my home in Maryland. The Department of Labor released monthly job numbers today. The U.S. unemployment rate jumped to 14.7% in April. That is the highest level since the Great Depression. Will these new numbers put pressure on states and cities to end social isolation policies sooner? As businesses start to open up nationwide, an influential coronavirus model often cited by the White House is now forecasting that 134,000 people will die of COVID-19 in the United States through the beginning of August. That's nearly double its previous prediction. National outrage over the killing of a black man in Georgia leads to two arrests. Politicians, including Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, call the death a lynching and condemn police for not taking immediate action against the suspects who were caught on video. And the Department of Justice drops its criminal case against Michael Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor. Joining us to talk about it all, Steve Clemens, editor-at-large of The Hill. Steve, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Maggie Fox is senior health editor at CNN. Maggie, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
And making his 1A debut, Jeff Stein, White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the jobless numbers because they're dire. They were released today. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced more than 20 million people lost their jobs in April. That brings the unemployment rate to nearly 15%, the highest, as I mentioned, since the Great Depression. Jeff, is this as bad as it sounds?
Yes, it really is. And I've just pulled up some of the numbers here. And really, there's nowhere to hide right now in this economy. Manufacturing, retail, healthcare, leisure, hospitality jobs. These sectors have shed millions of jobs in just 1 month. It's an unprecedented economic freefall, the likes of which we've really never seen in this country before. The charts that you'll see, you know, on the Post website and those of other media institutions, you can see that the current jobless claims are, when mapped, even including the Great Depression, the line from this month is so far beyond even the worst months of the Great Depression. This is an unprecedented collapse. I think if there is a measure, a modicum of a silver lining here, it's that somewhere in the order of 60% of these workers are temporarily furloughed. That's what they've said. And if that means anything, it's that, you know, the unemployment rate may be able to come down if these people are able to be recalled to work. But even then, that would still be an unemployment rate of 9%, which is really, really high. High even for the Great Recession, the brutal economic collapse of about 10 years ago. So it's a very dire picture.
We also got these news that two major retailers, J. Crew and Neiman Marcus, will file for bankruptcy. Why didn't the government's Paycheck Protection Program help those retailers?
You know, it's interesting because the media for the last month has been enormously fixated on the question of which firms are too large and undeserving of federal financial help. And so there's been a tremendous amount of outrage over, and I think in some cases justifiably, over the firms that were too big that received federal cash from the Paycheck Protection Program that shouldn't have. But what some people are saying about today's data is that it illustrates that in some ways the problem with this program was not that it was too generous for big firms, but that it was too limited for big firms, and not just big firms, but firms across the country. And there were strict limits on that money. They had to be used for certain costs, and they couldn't go to firms with more than 500 people. And a lot of businesses said, we're not going to be able to pay this back. And so they didn't take the money, and a lot of firms weren't able to get the money. So that's been a huge source of controversy. I will say, you know, in those two examples, those firms were under severe stress due to long-running sort of more more long-running changes than...
Yeah, long-term trends that are affecting
retailers. Yeah, long-term trends, exactly, than what's happening to the economy more broadly. But it is part of that issue, for sure.
Steve, does this jobless report, on top of the other bad jobless reports, does it affect the political calculus in states and their decisions on whether to reopen businesses or not?
I think it puts enormous pressure on states. I was talking to the Secretary for Banking and Securities in Pennsylvania the other day, for instance, telling me that the governor there, Tom Wolf in Pennsylvania, is, and we've seen this politically inside the state, is under incredible amounts of pressure. We've seen it with Governor Whitmer in Michigan. We've seen it in New Mexico. We see it, of course, in Georgia. And we see small business owners like the woman who's been in the news recently for a beauty salon who has tried to institute various hygienic practices for various clients who come in, but nonetheless was under order to shut it down, spent time in jail for not doing that. So there's a lot of pressure because while some people, there's still a lot of people employed out there, and there's some people staying at home, like we're all at home right now, we are nonetheless, some of us getting paychecks while others are not, and they can't necessarily feed their families. They don't know how they're going to pay their rent. They can't get their medicine. So there's an entire class of folks out there, which is a new underclass in America, caused by this. And so I think it really does put enormous pressure. And that's why this equilibrium between public health and reopening the economy is such a tug of war right now. It really, and then when you look at the Black community, you look at the Hispanic community, what Jeff just laid out, you know, with being a 14.7% basically unemployment rate here for the Black Americans, it's up in the 16%. Yeah. For Hispanic Americans, it's above 18%. So our communities of color right now are under siege and experiencing this even more brutally than you know, white Americans.
I want to, on this note, let me bring in this tweet that Sarah sent to us. I am a bartender and mother from Rhode Island, Sarah says. I've been out of work since the beginning of March. I applied for unemployment on April 1st and still have not gotten any info on my claim. Our neighbor applied last Monday and was approved and received a payment the next week. I'm at my wit's end and bills are piling up. And I want to put this to you, Jeff, because there are some who say the unemployment rate is actually worse than recorded simply because the system is so clunky that many people haven't been able to get through and apply, and or their applications haven't been looked at.
Yeah, I've spoken to dozens of people who have gone through the unemployment system and have horror stories that are similar to the one that you recounted. The unemployment system is just not set up in this country for the level of claims that we're seeing. This is just so off the charts. And not only are the claims off the charts, these are people who are, you know, the workers who are trying to process these claims are often working from home. Yeah. And so, you know, you're layering two crises on top of them at once.
Yeah.
And it's too much for them to handle. In a lot of other countries, the way they dealt with this was by maintaining payrolls. The government stepped in and worked with the payroll companies to maintain employment levels.
Yeah.
That, in some cases, would have been a more efficient way to do this than relying on state unemployment systems that, in some cases, have technology that date back to the 1980s.
Yeah.
They're using tech from 40 years ago to make this work. So it's not surprising in some senses that people are struggling to get through.
Okay, so speaking of reopening businesses, the Senate reopened on Monday.
And so for this work period, the Senate will shift out of the ranks of those Americans who are working remotely and into the ranks of Americans working in essential sectors who are listening to expert guidance and modifying their routines and ultimately continue to man their posts to keep the country running. If it's essential that brave healthcare workers, grocery store workers, truck drivers, and many other Americans continue to carefully show up for work, then it's essential that their U.S. senators carefully show up ourselves and support them.
That's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from the Capitol on Monday. Maggie, what were the rules that were put in place in order to get the Senate back to work?
Well, the obvious rules are there, the social distancing, the keeping away from one another, the regular cleaning of surfaces. Anybody who gets together like the Senate, it's very clear what they need to do. the virus is transmitted when people get close together and put their heads close together. So people need to stay apart from one another so that those particles can't pass back and forth. And those are the kind of rules that need to be in place when any organization gets back to work. You need to give people space.
Although the congressional doctor says he doesn't have enough tests for all the returning Congress people, will senators be tested only if they have symptoms?
That's not entirely clear. I know the Senate sort of turned away the opportunity to test everybody before they came back. And it's not clear if testing keeps you that safe anyway, because you can be exposed right after you've taken a test. The tests are useful for diagnosing and watching people over a population, determining where the virus is and how it's moving. What testing isn't especially useful for is telling you if you're safe from infecting somebody else. It's clear that you can infect people before you have any symptoms. It's not clear how long it takes for somebody to test positive after they've been exposed to the virus. So heavy reliance on these tests is probably not going to protect people.
And the House of Representatives remains closed, I assume because they're a larger body. We're going to talk about that and all the rest of the week's top national news. Steve Clemens joins us. He's editor-at-large of The Hill. Maggie Fox, you just heard, she's senior health editor at CNN. And Jeff Stein is White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. We have to take a quick break. We'll have more, though, right after this. So stay close. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
There's a lot going on in the world right now. You ever just feel like you want to talk it all out? Well, I'm here to help. My name is Sam Sanders. I host NPR's It's Been a Minute. Each week on my show, a bunch of smart guests and I talk about the news and the culture without making you feel overwhelmed. Join us every Friday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're discussing the week's top news headlines with Steve Clemens, editor-at-large of The Hill, Maggie Fox, senior health editor at CNN, Jeff Stein, a White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. So, Maggie, President Trump toured a mask factory in Arizona earlier this week. Neither the president nor those giving him the tour were wearing face masks. Trump later was said that he didn't know he needed to wear a mask. Where are we on masks and their efficacy in either preventing you from infecting others or preventing you from getting the virus?
People have studied this for many years, whether masks help you. Of course, the N95 masks, those respirators that are worn by health workers, are gauged and fitted against their face and protect people, as the name implies, against 95% of particles. What's less clear is what other face coverings do. The idea behind the current guidance is, A, to give something to do, give people something to do to make everyone aware of the need to protect others from any germs that you might have. And secondly, it's clear that this virus is far more transmissible than people thought it was at first. So anything that you can do to stop those droplets from your nose and mouth from going out and getting onto surfaces or splashing onto other people is a good thing to do, especially if you're in close quarters, like touring a factory when you're walking around shoulder to shoulder with other people. If you're, you know, at a table with somebody, if you're a clerk at a checkout counter or somebody in a restaurant, those masks can at least stop the largest particles. And each one of these little pieces of saliva or mucus or whatever coming out of your mouth can carry little pieces of virus in them, stop them from traveling. Now, these things fall to the ground after about 3 feet. So if you can get apart from people, the masks are less necessary. But I think society starting to agree that they're a great symbol of solidarity and a signal that you're going to do everything you can to protect everyone from you.
We're also seeing people, despite that, begin to question social distancing rules, including this Wisconsin justice.
where in the Constitution did the people of Wisconsin confer authority on a single unelected cabinet secretary to compel almost 6 million people to stay at home and close their businesses and face imprisonment if they don't comply with no input from the legislature, without the consent of the people? Isn't it the very definition of tyranny for one person to order people to be imprisoned for going to work, among other ordinarily lawful activities?
That was Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Bradley during oral arguments on Tuesday. Steve, tyranny is a strong word to use. What is this argument in the legal community, at least?
Well, I think among some and many libertarians, I don't know this justice, but there is a pulse out there among those that feel that the infringement of liberty, the infringement of their ability to make a living, their ability to see the people they want, we see that across America in many communities. We see it in the tension over some people who don't want to wear masks as they walk into stores and places that require masks. And we've seen some tragic killings and tragic encounters along that line. We heard Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla, in an earnings call the other day say that what the justice just spoke to, that those sorts of rules amount to fascism. That was the words he used. Yeah. And so I think that right now we're having a struggle over what the rights are out there of both individuals, but also governors. And so there's been some tension between governors and the White House over how to define who has the control and power to issue stay-at-home orders or to issue curfews and whatnot. And we're going to see this eventually play out in the courts. And I think we're going to have a very uneven tapestry in the United States of different models of reopening and different tensions about reopening. But it's very clear, you know, I have a house in rural Maryland, and you can feel in rural Maryland the notion that they shouldn't have to live under the same sorts of rules that Governor Larry Hogan has laid out for dense urban settings like Baltimore. Yeah. Maybe that's where it gets struggled out. But some people do feel that their liberties are being infringed, right, and that they have a problem with what they see as big government telling them what to do.
Let's stay with some legal issues here. We got news on Thursday from the Department of Justice that it dropped its criminal case against Michael Flynn. That is President Trump's former national security advisor. This move, I think it's fair to say, it surprised many experts all over the country. Steve, Flynn pled guilty twice to lying to FBI agents.
This is one of the most striking decisions that anyone has said. This, you know, if there were not people that were convinced that Attorney General Barr was a very different kind of Attorney General and that there was sort of a very new order in the Department of Justice, then this is the thing that has really hit them in the head. Because here, Michael Flynn, who we know was talking about rendering this minister Gulen back to Turkey. Turkey wanted him of having and lied to about calls with the Russians about sanctions, which he had lied about that. We know that he lied. He said that he lied. He confessed to lying. And Vice President Pence caught him lying. That all of these issues of how Michael Flynn lied to federal investigators were already on the table. And the fact that they've now dropped all charges against him is just a remarkable whiplash in this interesting ongoing attempt to demonize and undermine every aspect of what the Robert Mueller investigation was looking into.
How unusual is it for the Department of Justice to drop a case like this, to make this decision?
I've never seen anything like this in my many years of watching national security and intelligence investigations. Now, that's not to say that investigators don't get some things wrong. We've seen cases, in fact, David Rohde's new book about the so-called deep state out there right now, the Pulitzer Prize winning writer who's now at Reuters has written a lot about these various cases, and he has profiled times where the Department of Justice, where the FBI got things wrong. In this particular case, we know that the fundamental underlying acts that Michael Flynn engaged in were true because he was a cooperating witness for a long period of time. But as his political fortunes changed and as both Attorney General Barr and the president began leaning in to undo what the Department of Justice had done, they successfully moved something which people thought couldn't be moved, which was the wheels of justice are supposed to be objective, supposed to apply to all people equally. But if you're a friend of the president, if you're within the president's good graces, we're now seeing that certain people are more equal than others, and it's very disconcerting.
Well, let's go back to what Congress has been up to this week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell have been publicly negotiating the terms of a new stimulus package. The Democrats want more this time around. Speaker Pelosi had this to say during a weekly news conference Wednesday.
$150 billion for state and local. We'll have to do very much more than that. And Democrats and Republicans around the country, governors, mayors, county officials, etc., have been calling out for this funding.
So, Jeff, what exactly is different about this bill? It's $2 trillion, so it's a lot of money, but is there something different about it than the packages we've seen in the past couple months?
Well, I think the big difference is that Democrats are likely to drive a harder bargain than they did last time. There was a lot of talk. Democrats have made a number of demands and called for a number of measures, such as hazard pay, emergency pay for frontline workers, rental relief, much bigger than the very limited measures Congress has passed so far, worker protections through OSHA to make sure that workers on the job are protected and not forced into dangerous conditions. These are some of the demands that Democrats have been talking about for a long time, and there was a lot of frustration, I think, on the left that these demands did not get included in the last package. Democrats agreed to increase funding for the small business program, but did not really get any of these other big, important demands that they were making. This time, I think it's very likely that the PPP program runs out of money relatively soon. And it's also likely, this is informal, but my sense from sources on the Hill is that Republicans are beginning to become more understanding of the need to approve vast sums of state and local aid. So we could see movement on these policies soon, and it could give Democrats a chance to pass some of these things that have been rejected in the past few negotiations.
Although, Jeff, we have been hearing rumblings from the GOP that they want to be careful about how much they spend, and we're starting to hear people talk about the national debt again. What is that argument toward caution?
Well, so Congress has already spent well over $2 trillion, and we're looking at unprecedented deficit levels for the next few years. But I think from the more astute Hill observers I talked to, a lot of the concerns about deficit, while they're real for some members, Pat Toomey, Senator of Pennsylvania, very concerned about the deficit. In general, I think this is largely a negotiating position from Mitch McConnell, who's trying to prevent too much money from going out the door. But I don't think it's very likely that Republicans stop or sort of allow cities and states to cut hundreds and thousands of firefighter and police and other essential personnel jobs and just sit and twiddle their thumbs. I don't think that's going to be a tenable position for the Republican Party, even if some of them are concerned about the deficit.
So, Steve, there are other things happening in Washington besides a coronavirus. The Senate Intelligence Committee held a confirmation hearing for President Trump's nominee to be the next Director of National Intelligence. That's John Ratcliffe. His nomination was pulled last year because of a controversy, scandal. How has his name returned?
Well, John Ratcliffe is a three-term member of Congress, and you know, in our last round with Representative Ratcliffe, he said that he had put away 300 illegal immigrants in a day, that he'd arrested terrorists, and all of this was invented falsehood. And he was called out on it by Senator Mark Warner and others at the time, and he withdrew his nomination. I think today, I mean, all of those issues stand, and there are ongoing controversies. You know, I mean, I almost hate mentioning this because it's sort of odd to define anyone by Twitter, but you know, people are disconcerted or are worried that, you know, he follows some sites and some players on Twitter that have been some of the worst purveyors of conspiracy theories, and have been through the press looking at how, whether it was the Russians and various bots, but the worst conspiracy theorists in there are some of the folks. And Pizzagate was one of these, in particular Jim Alifaris's pizza store being a venue for, you know, a sex dungeon and, you know, pedophilia. Yeah. And we had a case there where in town someone actually took a gun and threatened people at that establishment. So he was following those kinds of people. But I think the bigger issue with John Ratcliffe is that we now know Senator Burr has indicated that next week they will have a vote in committee to pass him out of committee. They have enough votes to do that. They have enough votes to secure his confirmation in the Senate. And yeah. As Mark Warner said in this hearing, Senator Warner from Virginia, who's the ranking member of the Intel Committee, he said, look, you're many people want to vote for, you know, have you confirmed because they don't like the current acting director of national intelligence, Rick Grenell, ambassador to Germany, who is looked at as such a loyalist for the president. And because he's acting, he's not liable to Congress either. Mark Warner said that is not good enough for me to want to confirm you.
Yeah. Well, let's move back to COVID-19 and talk about the science a bit. We have various scientific models. They all predict that we'll experience a sharp surge in the U.S. death toll from COVID-19. That includes researchers at the University of Washington who predict the number of coronavirus deaths will double by August. Maggie, what is behind this huge increase in predicted fatalities?
Well, because states aren't doing everything that they need to do to keep on top of the virus. They're starting to reopen, even though the numbers are still rising. They're going to open up and give the virus more opportunity to circulate, and it expands exponentially when you do that. The major factor in passing a virus around is human behavior, and if people do not stay isolated, it is going to continue to spread and the numbers will continue to expand. The public health community is pretty much united on this, that until viral infections have been falling for 14 days straight, it's very dangerous for states to lift these restrictions that they have on people's movements and gatherings. As we've seen, people are very rebellious, and the minute they get a chance to get out and get around, they will forget the rules and gather in groups, and that's when the virus spreads. And these groups don't have to be that big. Some of the cases that we've seen of these big outbreaks have to do with family funerals, things like a manicure salon where one person can lead to many other infections.
Happened in California.
That's right. So it doesn't have to be that big a difference.
So we have a question, Steve, from a listener in the couple of minutes we have left. We had an email from Helen in North Carolina, who says, by what authority is Mr. Trump able to prevent Dr. Anthony Fauci from testifying before the House? Can't Dr. Fauci do that anyway? How is the president able to prevent him? Can you give us just a quick background on why there's a debate over Dr. Fauci testifying and whether or not the president has that authority?
Dr. Fauci, of course, is head of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Disease. And he works for the federal government. He works for the executive branch of the government. And the president can say to his staff, which we've seen over and over and over again in many, many cases, you're not going to testify. The House then can subpoena that individual. And in normal cases, in normal times, when rules have worked as they have in the past, that subpoenaed individual or government official is required to appear. That is now something under debate. Now, Tony Fauci has not been subpoenaed. Rosa DeLauro, her committee, which was a subcommittee of an appropriations committee dealing with this, is the one that asked to have him testify.
Yeah.
And she decided to proceed. They did not issue a subpoena to Fauci. But she made a comment. I interviewed her the other day for my daily coronavirus report at The Hill.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, Anthony Fauci has testified before her committee dozens of times, has testified in both chambers, the House and the Senate, hundreds of times. When the administration chose to block Fauci from appearing in the House, they did greenlight him appearing in the Health Committee in the Senate.
Well, and
so
Will, this is something
what the president is doing is saying we don't want him to speak because he doesn't like the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives.
And we're going to pause for just a moment on the week's news. We're hearing music from musician Yo-Yo Ma playing Tommaso Albinoni's Adagio in G minor. We can enjoy that for just a moment. Yo-Yo Ma said the music was for those who are grieving. We'll hear more from our guests and from you in just a moment.
The biggest story in the world is a science story. And keeping up with all the latest coronavirus research, it's a lot. So on Shortwave, we translate the science you need to know into short daily episodes. Listen and subscribe to Shortwave from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee. Let's get back to some of the news headlines. Again, staying with COVID-19. A top-ranking federal scientist was ousted from his post last month and has now filed a whistleblower complaint. Dr. Rick Bright says he was transferred out of his role at the Department of Health and Human Services for refusing to promote an unproven treatment for COVID-19. Maggie, can you explain what exactly happened here?
Well, I can explain what people said happened. As you'll recall, the White House was very strong in pushing this malaria drug, hydroxychloroquine, to treat coronavirus. There had been some initial tests that suggested it might work. But then some more studies came in, and it was pretty clear that this drug, if it was effective, it wasn't very effective, and it was causing some severe side effects. In effect, now the FDA and the NIH are warning against its use, except in experimental settings. And it appears that there was some disagreement in the White House about this. Rick Bright was transferred back to the NIH, and we've seen in his allegations, he said it was because he was upset over the promotion of this drug. And I guess this is going to have to play out within the White House. But it's clear that there are other drugs that work better. It's very unusual for all of this to be playing out like it is with the White House promoting things. Usually it's the CDC, the FDA, and the NIH who handle these matters.
We use that word unusual a lot. For example, the Food and Drug Administration has once again retightened regulations surrounding coronavirus tests. This is a reversal of a previous relaxing of those rules that caused more than 165 unauthorized tests to flood the market. Maggie, can you walk us through why the rules were relaxed and then why they've been tightened again?
Well, there's pressure, right? There was pressure for testing. As you'll recall, when the pandemic first started spreading across the U.S., there was a lot of pressure to get tests out there so that we could figure out who's infected and where it is. But those tests were delayed because of technical problems with the way they worked. And so the agencies that are trying to protect us said, you know what, we need to encourage people to get some other tests out there. If the CDC test isn't working, let's get the private sector involved. Let's encourage companies that might have some new technology to get these tests out there so that we can get some idea of where the pandemic is going. But that backfired, right? Because a bunch of these tests came out and they weren't any good at all. And in fact, a lot of the tests out there aren't terribly accurate. You have to have extremely high accuracy for these tests to tell you anything useful at all. We're talking at the level of above 99% accuracy in these tests, because for statistical reasons, if you have less accuracy than that, then up to half of the tests could be wrong. So the FDA dialed it back. They said, whoops, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that's not very good. Let's bring it back and make sure that these people give these tests to us to validate, or at least show us that they have validated those tests, because right now, a lot of them are worse than useless. Because of course, if you take a test and it's told you that you aren't infected and it's wrong, people could be very much encouraged to go out and mix and mingle and perhaps spread the virus even more.
Let's move on to a grimmer and altogether more tragic subject. And even so, police arrested and charged two suspects Thursday in the shooting death of an unarmed black jogger in Georgia. Video released this week shows two white men chasing down and then murdering 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden says Arbery was, quote, shot down in cold blood, essentially lynched before our very eyes, 2020 style, unquote. Steve, this happened, this incident occurred a couple months ago. What are the most recent developments? What's driving them?
Well, a video appeared that showed this Mr. Arbery running and actually running towards the pickup, the vehicle where the two gentlemen now charged with murder were standing. And that video has changed everything. But through this time, it had echoes of, I think, a nightmarish past for many, that justice was not delivered or pursued after a man was out jogging. His family knew he was innocent, and a kind of broad network of people in a community turned a blind eye and or an alleged blind eye to justice in this case, and did not bring these two alleged perpetrators in. And I think it has brought back a lot of those wounds of racism and systemic racism in the South, in Georgia. And it was, as we've seen in many cases, the video that turned around. And I think all of us that look at this say, how many times has this happened where there wasn't a video? But the video emerged, and it has changed the game here.
So the prosecutors had declined to charge these two men before, who claimed that they went to chase him down because they saw him running down the street. And there had been a couple of burglaries in the neighborhood, although those burglaries were not reported to the police. There's no record of any report. Why, any idea why prosecutors had declined to charge these two men before now? Arbery was killed in February.
I can't speculate on why they didn't. We just know that they didn't. I think that what many people are concerned about, and what many of the folks who are family members of Mr. Arbery and folks in the community that were outraged in the state, the protests are, that this was yet again a black man that was killed impunity and murdered, and that the community decided to turn a blind eye and to stand by those that were the alleged perpetrators in this case. That is the speculation. As I've looked at this and looked at the broad question of what was going on with burglaries, what was going on in the community, it's just really, it shocks the soul to some degree and shocks the conscience that there wasn't more of an effort at that time before the video emerged to investigate what may have happened. And I think one of the issues here is that one of the gentlemen has been charged, the elder of the two, their father, son, was part of the local police before. And so it has some, as I said, what this brings back is sort of a nightmarish set of relations in the past, where people would see communities that are related and they turn a blind eye when someone is murdered. And I can't say that's what happened in this case, but I think that is what is driving a lot of the protests out there and the call for justice. And now these two have been arrested.
As I mentioned, we did hear from the Democrats nominee, presumptive nominee Joe Biden on this. Have we heard from President Trump on this case?
Not to my knowledge. I have heard nothing from President Trump.
Also, a video shot in New York's East Village this weekend shows a plainclothes police officer very violently enforcing social distancing orders.
What are you flexing for? Don't flex. You got lost up too. Look. He ain't even do nothing. He's violent. He ain't even do nothing. Look.
So the phone video shows Officer Francisco Garcia kneeling on the neck of Donnie Wright. He's also seen brandishing a taser and punching another man. U.S. Representative Hakeem Jeffries of Brooklyn tweeted this: why are sunbathers who violate social distancing guidelines treated one way and young men in certain communities another? Maggie, that's a perfectly credible question. Are we seeing disparate enforcement of social distancing guidelines?
Well, of course we are, because this enforcement is state by state, community by community, city by city. So different areas are going to have different types of enforcement. This is not a federal mandate coming down. These matters have been left up to states, to local communities. And of course, there'll be different circumstances. We see that with all sorts of things across the country, but especially with public health rules. It's local decisions.
And Steve, again, this brings us back to the question of the right of law enforcement to ensure social distancing guidelines. Is there any federal effort, or is there any way the federal government could step in and make those more uniform across the nation?
Of course. I mean, what you would normally expect, I've talked to both Republican and Democratic members of Congress, all of whom express a kind of disappointment in the failure of government as a whole to create a set of best practices, of guidelines. We even saw CDC best practices from the Centers for Disease Control rejected by the White House. So there's a kind, in my view, there's sort of a Keystone Cops operation at the federal level, and thus you have now states and localities trying to develop without federal guidance, without clear consensus on how to create a relatively uniform and commonsensical standard so that people have trust in government. What's remarkable is that people are looking to the government. The Edelman Trust Barometer just came out, for instance, shows a massive surge in trust in government because people are looking to the government for direction. But exactly that moment, the government is not providing those frames that would help police, that would help first responders, that would help local mayors and governors. You know, again, out in Chestertown, Maryland, the mayor of that town's been struggling over how to handle a farmer's market because it sort of was the community social place. There is not a standard set of best practices that have been issued. But your question is, shouldn't the federal government do this? Absolutely yes. Is it doing so? Absolutely not. And in my view, it's derelict in its responsibility.
Also, other news coming out of Washington, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos released final regulations for schools that are dealing with sexual misconduct. Maggie, how different are these rules than they were under the previous administration?
For dealing with sexual misconduct, well, of course, it's been completely turned upside down. There's a lot less interest in this administration than there was in the previous administration.
And Steve, what do these new rules do? There are a number of people saying they are insufficient.
What the new rules do is that they require, in cases of sexual harassment, a level of action, a level of violation that is far greater than what the Obama rules set. So catcalls or regular non-physical verbal abuses are now ones that would be not acted on under DeVos's just issued guidelines and rules. It also creates a dispute resolution mechanism that doesn't bring people back, you know, face to face, but it gives both sides an opportunity. And in essence, what it does is it erodes the kind of protections for the violated, and it enhances the rights and standing of the accused. And I think where you are in the various sense of this, we have had concern that in our society, women are abused and their status has, you know, and their legal status and their legal protections, particularly women, but it's not only women, need to be enhanced in these sexual harassment cases. And so it is minimized and narrowed the aperture of actions that can be taken for what is, and redefine sexual harassment to some degree. So it's very provocative, and it really, in my view, it diminishes a lot of the territory for taking action in what we used to consider broad sexual harassment, much of it verbal and psychological.
We just found out that Yamiche Alcindor of PBS News tweeted that President Trump actually watched the video we spoke of earlier that showed the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery. And the president said, "I saw the tape. It's very disturbing. I will say that looks like a really good young guy. It's a very disturbing situation to me. My heart goes out to the parents and the family and the friends." That just occurred. So that's just an update. We have just like a minute or so left, Maggie. And I wonder, one last little bit of science news before we go. Researchers have identified hundreds of mutations to coronavirus. That's no surprise. Viruses mutate. But is it possible that these mutations are showing coronavirus is starting to get weaker?
No. And there's been a lot of debate about this. Science is really confusing right now because we're in a totally different time in this pandemic in terms of publishing scientific information and trying to keep on top of it when there is a real-time emergency going on. Usually, scientific studies take a lot of time to come out, and they go through a peer review process, and you see them formally published in these journals after many people have weighed in and had a look at it. We're now in the days of what's called preprints, and people just throw their research up online. Now, scientists are used to having this stuff debated, and sometimes they'll throw kind of wacky theories out there and say, what do you think of this? And everybody else weighs in and says, no, this isn't right, or yes, this is right. And before it's ever made public, it is thoroughly vetted. Now we have unvetted studies going online, and journalists can see them, the public can see them, and other scientists can see them, and they're getting debated out in real time. And some of them have more scientific merit than other ones do. These things are worth investigating. It's worth investigating whether the genetic changes in the virus actually are changing the way it's acting. And it's perfectly reasonable to think that as the virus spreads more commonly, it will become less dangerous because evolution would push it in that direction. Yeah. But there's been a lot of debate over the validity of some of the very strong conclusions out of some of the genetic studies.
Maggie Fox is senior health editor at CNN, Steve Clemens, editor-at-large of The Hill, and Jeff Stein, White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks to all of you. We want to note that our broadcast is fully remote. All of our producers, hosts, and engineers operating from our homes. And that would not be possible without the amazing team of engineers at WAMU. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Eileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor. Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for the international section of our news roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, and it's time for the international edition of our news roundup. The United Nations Secretary General says the pandemic has unleashed a, quote, tsunami of hate and xenophobia, unquote, which needs to be defeated. The World Health Organization warns it could take a year to determine the exact origins of the coronavirus. And on this day, 75 years ago, Germany formally surrendered to the Allies. As we speak, the 75th anniversary of VE Day is being marked around the world. Our guests this week are David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. David is a News Roundup warrior, and he joins us from Beijing. David, welcome back.
Hello.
Jennifer Williams is co-host of the podcast Worldly. That's produced by Vox, where she is senior foreign editor. Jenny, great to have you back. Jen, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
I didn't mean to call you Jenny. Actually, the reason I called you that is because your Twitter handle says Jen from the Vox. So it's stuck in my head, Jenny.
No problem.
Covering foreign affairs and the State Department for the Wall Street Journal is Jessica Donati. Jessica, we appreciate you giving your time as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's begin with this global alliance of world leaders. They've pledged more than $8 billion to develop vaccines and treatments to fight COVID-19. Here is what European Union Commission President Ursula von der Leyen had to say at a virtual summit held on Monday.
In the space of just a few hours, we have collectively pledged 7.4 billion euros for vaccines, diagnostics, and treatments. And all this money will help kickstart unprecedented global cooperation. And it will create a truly unique global public good.
Donors include the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Saudi Arabia, not the US. Jessica, any idea why the United States has chosen not to donate to this and didn't even go to the summit to discuss it?
Well, interestingly, that we had a briefing with the top foreign aid officials at the State Department on this, and reporters asked them this question about four times, and in the end they got quite testy and just sort of shut us off. But I think we can assume that this is just part of their general sort of administration skepticism of large international organizations and generally not wanting to be seen of any part of initiative that doesn't bash China on the coronavirus thing.
And Jennifer, do we know how close $8 billion could get us to a vaccine? In other words, is the plan coming from this global alliance realistic?
Well, you know, honestly, any amount of money that we can throw at this is going to be helpful. $8 billion is a lot more than $0 throwing at this vaccine effort. But, you know, it's a huge effort, and many countries around the world are working on this independently. This movement was basically trying to not only raise money, but also to kind of present a united front, to kind of say we're all in this together. This isn't a competition. And, you know, the United States has been, President Trump in particular, has more been presenting it as this is a competition. That shouldn't be surprising for anyone who knows President Trump and how he tends to view the world as this kind of, you know, zero-sum game, and I win, you lose. And so basically it's meant to, one, throw money at this problem, but also to kind of show that, like, this is a collective push that we're all trying to make here, whereas Trump is trying to kind of maintain that America first posture that he's had basically since he became president.
Well, earlier this week, we spoke with David Miliband, the president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. We spoke on Monday. He explained how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting refugees globally, and we want to share this particular moment that stood out.
One other point that's important, public information is a massive problem in the places where we work. Fake news isn't just confined to the US or to Europe. The fake news about the disease is one of the most corrosive aspects of it because it interferes with the trust that is essential for people to actually follow the instructions.
And I wonder if I could get all of you to react to that particular claim. David, you first. What are your thoughts about this idea of global mistrust and misinformation?
Well, he's put his finger on something pretty central. I mean, clearly, it's one thing to have this conference on Monday where every leader is saying, you know, it's humanity against the virus. I think that's what Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, said. But we all know that when the first vaccine that does work, and we hope there will be one soon, comes along, that is going to be a gigantic test. Because if the country that develops it is determined to be selfish and to hoard that vaccine and to then deliver that, having vaccinated their own public, to then sort of deliver that to their friends and people who are willing to thank them, then you'll see a vaccine for this unbelievably important pandemic becoming a tool of geopolitical power. And I think that frightens a lot of people.
Jennifer, what, anything to add to that idea?
Yeah, absolutely. On the fake news aspect in particular, you know, the fact that, you know, someday we will hopefully have a vaccine for this is great, but you have to understand and think about the fact that vaccines in general are still, you know, highly doubted by entire segments of populations, including in the United States, in large part because of the fake news phenomenon and because, you know, people, the anti-vaxxer kind of movement shares, you know, incorrect and false scientific information. And so the fear I think a lot of people have is, you know, when it comes to finally actually having a solution to stop this virus in its tracks, you know, whether that will actually be adopted by a lot of people. And depending on who produces the first vaccine, you know, if it comes from, for example, China, which is working, you know, very hard, as well as other countries, yeah. You know, whether there will be trust in maybe in the United States, given the kind of anti-China backlash that has been happening because of the virus. So will people even trust the vaccine to be safe? Will there be an anti-vax movement?
We got this comment from Eric on Facebook who says Trump is alienating the entire world. As Trump continues to do this, we'll be lucky if any country ever assists the U.S. when we need it. As you mentioned, China is making progress in finding this coronavirus vaccine. Chinese companies have gotten resources from the government there. Four of them have started human trials. That's progressing much faster than vaccine efforts in the U.S. and Britain. So, David, the vaccine industry in China, it has been marked with controversy and mistrust before. Do these drug companies have the trust not just of the Chinese people, but of the world at large?
Bluntly, no. And it's got to scare people in America who are worried about China that one of the leading candidates at the moment in China is a partly People's Liberation Army effort. And the front face of that is a military scientist, Major General Chen Wei, who's being sort of made into this big propaganda figure here as she sort of tests the vaccine on herself. And so, you know, if a PLA general is the face of this vaccine, then I think everything that you've heard so far about doubts is going to be multiplied a hundredfold. There's also the problem that the Chinese public is being told by the state media propaganda, which is the only media they're allowed to hear, that this virus might have come from America. And in fact, you've had some pretty senior officials implying or insinuating that the American military might have sent it to Wuhan, the city where it first was discovered. And so there's paranoia on this side too. An awful lot of Chinese, not all, but an awful lot of Chinese wonder if it came from America.
Jessica, does it seem as though the scramble, the race to find a vaccine or at least an effective treatment is beginning to resemble a new space race that could really be impacted by diplomacy and geopolitics?
I mean, yes, I think it's possible for all the reasons that we've outlined, going back to this sort of fake news aspect where despite these global efforts to present a united front, countries have become extremely critical of each other, and the relationship between the US and China has worsened. So again, if one or the other ends up being the front runner in this race, whether it will improve things, I think, is an open question.
And President Trump seems confident the U.S. will come up with a vaccine and come up with it quickly. He led a virtual town hall hosted by Fox News on Sunday and said he expected a vaccine to be available by the end of the year. And he wants more of those drugs to be made here in the U.S.
Look, we have to get a vaccine. Whoever gets it, I'm gonna be their best fan. And I need the vaccine. This country needs the vaccine. And you're going to have it by the end of the year. I firmly believe
when
it.
When will we get that 94% of antibiotics made in this country? Do you have a target date for that?
I think we will have it done within 2 years. You know, it doesn't go that quickly.
Jessica, this announcement about the drug industry, 95% of drugs made here, can the president promise that?
I mean, we've seen the president made a lot of statements and a lot of promises that get reversed. I wouldn't sort of say that's cast in stone, but I think that's the general idea that has come out of this, is that countries like the U.S., but also European countries, need to diversify their sources of access to medication. As we saw when China shut down at the beginning of the year, that created a lot of supply problems. So I think generally the ambition to move some of that production back to the U.S. and back to Europe is probably a real thing.
So President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have been pushing this theory that the outbreak has its origins at a Wuhan lab in China rather than occurring nationally at a wet market, as most experts say. So here is Pompeo on ABC's The Week. He was asked about his thoughts on the likelihood that the virus originated in a lab.
There's enormous evidence that that's where this began. We've said from the beginning that this was a virus that originated in Wuhan, China. We took a lot of grief for that from the outset, but I think the whole world can see now. Remember, China has a history of infecting the world, and they have a history of running substandard laboratories. These are not the first times that we've had a world exposed to viruses as a result of failures in a Chinese lab.
David, is this a specific lab that he is talking about, and what do we know about it?
He is. He has very recently backed away a little bit from that, partly because other intelligence close allies of the United States, particularly in Australia, have basically said, whoa, you know, we do not have that kind of hard evidence, and we don't know what he means by enormous evidence. So we need to be clear what we're talking about. The United States does not seem to be maintaining that this is an artificial, kind of man-made, laboratory-made virus that sort of was released as a bioweapon. I think they do concede that if you look at the genetic code of this, it's naturally occurring. It seems to be a mutation, probably from horseshoe bats, then perhaps via one more species. And you've had, for example, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who you've had on your show many times, I know the kind of the top virologist in the US, saying that it's clearly natural, it's not man-made. So the accidental release is what they're really talking about. And the reason that we're talking about Wuhan as a place where that might have happened, it does happen to be the place where China's highest security lab is, the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It was only opened a couple of years ago. And it has the world's highest level of, as this biosafety 4 level, which means you can have the world's most dangerous diseases there. And they were studying bat viruses. And what's interesting is I've been here throughout this entire thing. Back in January, February, particularly in February, there was a lot of rumors on Chinese social media that maybe it did escape from this lab because people noticed that it was seeing the same kind of bat viruses. The problem is that there just isn't hard evidence that it got out. This lab is about 8 miles away from the market, was the original kind of area where we first saw these cases. And the truth is, we may never know. So this is really becoming a political row about whether you can blame the Chinese for unleashing this thing, whether they're to blame for all the deaths in America. And the charge here from the Chinese, which I think has a kernel of truth to it, is that the Trump administration was pretty complimentary, including President Trump, about how China was running the virus control early on. But then when the numbers started to mount terrifyingly in America, it became time to blame China. And so there's a kind of sense this isn't really about science at all. It's about propaganda.
To that end, Jennifer, health and intelligence officials have been pretty clear that they have not seen the evidence that Pompeo mentioned in that clip there. Is there internal disagreement within the Trump administration, or is that a united front?
I'm not sure there's ever been a united front within the Trump administration on any issue, and I don't think that this is any different. You know, we even had this remarkable moment when, you know, the director of national intelligence put out this statement saying, you know, as David mentioned, that this was not a man-made virus, that this is naturally occurring. And you had a journalist asking President Trump directly about that statement. And he essentially said, yeah, okay, well, who is that? Who's the guy? Who's the name of the guy who put out the statement? And was saying, oh, and he's supposed to know. And I think it was John Roberts of Fox News who was saying, sir, this is your director of national intelligence. Like, this is your highest intelligence chief who is saying this. And it was a remarkable moment where, you know, the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. And you know, Trump is challenging the expertise of some unnamed person before realizing this was the head of his intelligence. In terms of the actual evidence, my colleague Eliza Barkley at Vox did a remarkable investigation into this to see, you know, what we know and what we don't know about this Wuhan Institute of Virology and whether this virus could have come from there. And she spoke with a huge amount of scientists, many of whom, most of whom had worked directly with scientists in that lab. And they all said, look, the level of security is very, very high there. It's incredibly unlikely that this escaped. And it's highly likely, you know, including one scientist who had actually done a study polling the population and looking at to see who had actually been exposed in Yunnan, China, to bat-linked coronaviruses. And many people in the population showed that they had antibodies for it. So these viruses are already out in the population. It's something that we know very well. So the likelihood that this jumped you know, in a wet market or in the population is so much higher than the likelihood that it escaped from a lab.
So it has become a point of contention. There's escalating rhetoric in some cases, and there's a lot of blame by the U.S. over China's handling of the pandemic. That same interview that we played an excerpt of earlier, Mike Pompeo also said Chinese officials attempted to conceal and hide and confuse. David, as you mentioned, you have been in China throughout this entire incident, this entire pandemic. How can we separate U.S.-China diplomatic relations from the arguments over data and statistics and vaccine progress and the medical information that the world really desperately needs to have settled?
I can tell you that a whole bunch of other countries are desperate for exactly that to happen, and they're somewhat despairing that the United States and China appear to be heading ever further in the wrong direction. I mean, so it's clear that President Trump, even, you know, a few hours ago, tried to sort of repeat the lab theory, saying that, you know, somebody was stupid, maybe it was incompetence. It should be said that the Chinese propaganda machine, including their most official kind of party newspapers, have been trying to sort of insinuate that there's a high-tech military bioweapons lab, Fort Detrick, not that far from you in Maryland, which had a shutdown for safety reasons last year. They keep pumping this out and saying, you know, hard questions must be asked about what was released during that accident. Is Fort Detrick where this virus came from? So they're playing their games. Other countries are just desperate for China and America to get back to playing the role of leading scientific advanced countries and work out how to defeat this virus. Because until we get a vaccine, all of these lockdowns and quarantines can't really stop completely. So this couldn't be more important, and people couldn't be more upset by how both superpowers are behaving.
Jennifer, do we get the sense that this battle between the U.S. and China is temporary and will last as long as the crisis over COVID-19? Or are we seeing a change in diplomatic relations between the two countries?
Well, there are factions within the Trump administration who have long been hawkish on China, including, you know, Steve Bannon, who is no longer in the administration proper, but is still very influential and has the ear of many people. He has long been hawkish on China. There are other officials in the trade space and in the economic space that have been trying to kind of push China hard on trade. We know that, you know, Trump launched this trade war almost immediately during his presidency. So that itself is not new. Now, Trump himself had a relationship. He seemed to have a close and positive relationship with Xi Jinping. And so that seemed to kind of be this weird one-off situation that kind of went against and contradicted the broader policy. But there are many people within the administration right now who are pushing Trump to really attack and punish China in some way, not militarily attack, meaning, but in terms of, you know, potential, you know, sanctions, or there was discussion of potentially stripping China's sovereign immunity so that people in the United States, states and citizens could sue China for damages over the release of the virus and its handling of the virus. Trump even talked about putting new tariffs on China to try to punish it. He still seems to not quite understand how tariffs work and doesn't really understand that U.S. consumers would be the ones paying that, but that's another issue entirely. But there are definitely, you know, forces in the U.S. and in the Trump administration specifically who really want Trump to go harder on China. He, in fact, seems to be the one that is kind of somewhat more resistant to that. I think he is aware of the impact that could have on the broader policy on trade negotiations, on you know, the trade relationship. And so he seems to be somewhat hesitant on that end. But it's definitely something that we're going to continue to see for the foreseeable future.
Let's move to Europe. For weeks now, sports stadia around the world have been pretty quiet and empty. This week, though, to the relief of sports-starved fans all over the world, Germany has decided it is now safe to bring back this.
Grafitsch. Still Grafitsch. Tight knots in the complete defense. Brilliant stuff. Oh, and it's gone in for the goal of the season. What a goal. I'm going to do a Brazilian one here now.
That is soccer. Germany's Bundesliga will restart on May 16th. Chancellor Angela Merkel says the goal of slowing the spread of coronavirus has been achieved. So, German shops and soccer stadia can now reopen. Jen, first, help me out to understand Angela Merkel's place here, because I was under the impression that she had planned to retire.
Yeah, she has said that she is stepping down from power. And as far as we know, you know, she is still planning to do so. I think she's going to you know, finish out her term through 2021. So the world still has a little bit longer with Angela Merkel. One of my colleagues, Jen Kirby, spoke with a bunch of experts and political folks in Germany and asked that very question. Basically, you know, has the coronavirus pandemic and the need for strong leadership changed her mind? And basically, the resounding answer was, once Angela Merkel makes up her mind, she does not go back on it. So it seems like she is still planning to step down. But it's really remarkable that, you know, the world is looking basically desperately for someone to be the grown-up in the room, for someone to take the serious, sober approach to this. And Angela Merkel has really stepped up and been the one who has communicated clearly with no nonsense about, you know, the need for social distancing, you know, about the stakes in this virus. And I think a lot of people are worried that, you know, what happens if this pandemic doesn't end anytime soon and we lose that leadership. I think it's really remarkable that, you know, again, that the United States is not the one being looked to be this strong, sober-minded leader, right, but rather Angela Merkel.
So, David, I have no idea if you watch soccer or do not, but can you explain why it's such a big deal that soccer is coming back?
The only live sports being played anywhere in the world at the moment, I think, is baseball in Taiwan, which is fantastic. Taiwan has had a fantastic, successful virus control. I think South Korea is also playing baseball. But if you're not a South Korean baseball nut, I can see it's a little frustrating that that's the only professional sport being played. And the Bundesliga is one of the big rich European soccer leagues. I think what's fascinating, though, is how confident Angela Merkel is of the trust that she enjoys kind of across the party lines in Germany, so that even as she was announcing this kind of good news that shops in a very cautious way will reopen and that the Bundesliga will be playing again, she immediately said, but we will have an emergency break. And she explained how it will work, that if there's more than, I think it's 50 new infections in any area with 100,000 people in it, then they will go back and shut it down again. Remember, she's a trained physicist before she was a politician. One of the most impressive things, I think, for Europeans has been watching these press conferences that she gives, where she explains things like the effective reproduction number, this RT number that tells you at any given time whether a given infected person is infecting more or less than one other person. And she explains the consequences that has for the German health system. It's kind of a science lecture, but she's really good at it. And I think that explains why she can deliver good news, but then with a kind of warning that it might be taken away, and people trust her.
Germany's 16 federal states are under an agreement with the government, and they're going to take control of the timing of the reopening, as we've been hinting here. They will operate a so-called emergency break if there's a new rise in infections. Here's the German Chancellor Angela Merkel explaining that.
Ich vertraue den Bürgerinnen und Bürgern. Vertrauen ist der Grundsatz, und dann muss man natürlich ab und zu auch kontrollieren. Das ist klar.
Basically, she's saying that she has to place her trust in the citizens and the local officials, mayors and health authorities. Jessica, how similar is the system that she's describing there to the American system?
I think we can see the one of the main differences is that in Germany, everyone is pretty much on board with her plan, while in the US, it's become an extremely controversial issue when to open and when to not reopen. So I think the messaging is different there.
And, you know, one last thing before we go and take a break. Today is the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe. I just wanted to give you just each a brief moment to talk about this journey that's been traveled by Germany since 1945. And we're talking about Angela Merkel being the leader of the effort, the global effort right now. Jennifer, did you want to reflect on that?
Absolutely. I think it's an incredibly stark moment. Again, as I said, the world is essentially looking to Angela Merkel right now, and Europe in particular, as the sober-minded leader who is doing the right thing, who is taking the right steps, who is acting responsibly. And the United States, you know, under President Trump, is being seen as this erratic, untrustworthy, you know, kind of loose cannon. And it's such a stark difference of, you know, what we saw at the end of World War II. So I think it's just remarkable to see how much has changed over time and how well Germany has done in rehabilitating its image over the years.
Jessica, did you also want to make a comment?
I mean, yes, we also have, the fraying of the relationship between the U.S. and Europe. The U.S. has recently downgraded again its ambassadorship to the EU. They didn't participate in the EU's global fundraising conference for the vaccine, and relationship has been sort of on the rocks, especially since the Trump administration has taken over. So that's something that we have to watch in the next sort of, you know, few years.
David, in 30 seconds, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, look, I live and work in a country that is drenched in blood from historical crimes committed by their own leaders and foreign invaders. And we see seething, terrifying nationalism being stoked here for political reasons. We realize every day just what a miracle Germany is, perhaps the only country in history to stare squarely and unapologetically at its own wickedness and say, yes, we did this and we're sorry and we will not defend it in any way. That's a miracle.
And it's something to be marked, not just the 75th anniversary, but what has changed in the world since that time. Well, turning now to a regrettable new reality, the United Kingdom has the second highest number of COVID-19 cases in the world. The death toll in the UK is now higher than in Italy's, which leaves the British Prime Minister facing a lot of questions. Listen to this. This is an exchange between Boris Johnson and the new leader of the opposition, Sir Keir Starmer.
At this stage, I don't think that international comparisons and the data is yet there to draw the conclusions that we want.
Keir Starmer.
I'm afraid that many people are concluding that the answer to my question is that the UK was slow into lockdown, slow on testing, slow on tracing, and slow on the supply of protective equipment.
David, we know that the Prime Minister has enjoyed an amount of sympathy after coming through a very tough battle with COVID-19. When do we expect public sympathy may run out for him?
It's a mess. I mean, there's no defending how Britain has handled this. And I think the people are drawing political kind of lessons that populists who get elected on promising things that aren't true are not the people you want in charge of your country when there's a real serious crisis that you can't spin away. And I know that will resonate with people outside Britain too. And that is basically the rap that Boris Johnson is someone who lied his way into winning the Brexit referendum and then told everyone what they wanted to hear, because that's his thing. To get elected with a pretty handsome majority. He's now coming up against the right of his own party. Again, this will resonate for American listeners, I'm sure, because the right of his party wants to open up and to take it on the chin. But I think the British public is kind of confused and frightened as to how a rich country with a good health service has ended up in such a mess.
I think that feeling is also being felt in the US. You mentioned Brexit. That is still in progress. So is all of this expected to take a significant impact between Brexit up in the air and the coronavirus? How will the UK economy bounce back? UK economy.
Look, it's really scary. The whole pitch of Brexit was that Britain would be this kind of zippy little kind of buccaneering sailing ship that would cut free of the European kind of morass and zoom around the world being this high-tech trading superpower. The problem is that we're now going to be broke because we're spending money as everyone is having to. The Bank of England just said that we're expecting the worst recession since 1709. Why 1709? Because that's when there was such a terrible winter that the Thames froze solid for several months. We've had a 30% drop in output the first half of this year. So all of that, plus the massive debts we're racking up, are going to collide with the end of the transition period when Britain really does go it alone from the European Union, and the world wonders whether we're solvent. And I think sensible people are worrying a lot about that moment.
Jessica, I think this is also a moment for people to talk about the position that the UK occupies in the world, right? How has this changed diplomatic relations and the relations of the EU especially, but other countries with the UK?
I mean, I think it's probably been quite a humiliating turnout for the UK, where at the beginning they said, we're going to do our own thing. They were very slow to implement measures. Hospitals were really unprepared. They turned away a lot of people that were getting sick and then ended up with a much higher number of deaths than they should have had. And as we mentioned before, now European countries are looking to Germany as a model, and even Italy, a country which isn't usually thought of being particularly organized, now has taken control of its infection rates. It has a plan which pretty much everybody there agrees on to slowly reopen the economy. And so I think that the UK really has been left behind.
Let's move to another country. Brazil has more official positive coronavirus cases than any other country in the Americas, besides the United States. At last check, Brazil had nearly 130,000. Those are the official numbers from the Brazilian government, though. A study this week suggested there could be 10 times as many cases, up to 1.6 million. Jen, how could there be such a difference between the reported cases coming from the government and the numbers that these studies suggest?
Well, studies like this are being done basically looking at things like transmission rates, so that the R-naught rate. Looking at basically, I think David mentioned this earlier, how many people, you know, per one person does a person infect, and kind of extrapolating those. And you know, looking at that kind of data, it suggests that there's a lot more, you know, cases than are being reported. In Brazil, you have, you know, a similar situation that we've seen, you know, around the world in terms of testing, where testing is not being done at the scale that it should be, which means that there's a massive potentially underlying infection rate that nobody is even aware of, because not enough people are being tested to even know what they're dealing with. But with Brazil, on top of that, you have a leader in Jair Bolsonaro who is openly flaunting all social distancing rules himself, who is taking an astonishingly cavalier approach to the entire pandemic. He was asked, the other week about the number of cases rising, and he responded, quote, "So what? What do you want me to do?" I mean, this is the leader of the country with a horrific outbreak that's growing every day. They're now topped 9,000 dead, and he still continues to just act as if it's just a little flu and no big deal, and he doesn't care. And it's just horrific to watch this happen.
You know, while states in the country struggle desperately to try to manage it on their own when the federal government is basically just ignoring it.
This is just another example of how politics have complicated many nations' response to the pandemic. And I wonder if you could give us some political context on why Bolsonaro is making those decisions. What is happening in Brazil that's influencing the response to COVID-19?
So, you know, as David mentioned earlier, I think his point was spot on about populists. I think there's the similar kind of dynamic happening here, where you have leaders who came into power for a lot of reasons, promising, you know, a dynamic economy, promising to fix all these you know, woes that the country has faced, but largely doing this based on lies and spin and no actual, you know, solid policies. And Jair Bolsonaro is desperately trying to hold on to power by, you know, saying that the economy is going to be strong. We're not going to let the economy, you know, fail. And I think he's desperate to keep the country open so that that comes true. He's also, you know, been opportunistic in using this to try to, you know, potentially increase his power. But it seems like, you know, the emperor has no clothes at this point. I think people are starting to realize in Brazil and as David mentioned, you know, in the UK and elsewhere that, you know, this kind of leadership is not what you want in a crisis. The editorials and all the top newspapers in Brazil have called for Bolsonaro to step down. You know, it's nearly impossible to hide, you know, bodies in the streets and overloaded hospitals and people dying left and right with clever spin and quips about fake news. You know, when the reality runs up against rhetoric, reality wins every time.
Well, you can put that onto a plaque. In neighboring Venezuela, an odd story, two Americans were arrested over the weekend for their alleged role in a plot to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. The two men were former U.S. Special Forces soldiers. Venezuela released a highly edited video on Wednesday that appears to show one of the men confessing. Meanwhile, the Trump administration denies any involvement in the alleged plot. Jessica, can you explain what's happening here?
Yeah, and I mean, this is the kind of story that you really couldn't make it. You couldn't make it up, and if you did, nobody would believe you, right? So this guy who, the ringleader of this all was Jordan Goudreau, who was also a former Special Forces guy who had his own contracting company. And through a series of, I guess, sort of fortunate Instagram posts and bluffing, he managed to convince a whole group of Venezuelan freedom fighters and a couple of his own sort of former Green Beret colleagues that it would be a good idea to try and invade Venezuela and topple the government on basically with two canoes and 12 rifles. The plan has sort of failed spectacularly.
They were planning to overthrow a government with two canoes and 12 rifles? Allegedly?
Yeah, so, I mean, in practice as well, I spoke to a former Navy SEAL who went over to provide medical training unconnected to the operation. And he said that some of these, that the freedom fighters were training with sticks, basically. They didn't even have guns, but they told him, we're going to have a helicopter air assault and we're going to have Navy warships. And they'd been promised that the U.S. government was totally behind this. And this Navy SEAL told me that he thought that from the start, it was clear that they were being misled and that there was, if there had been U.S. government backing, they wouldn't be in a camp with very little running water or food and no weapons.
So the latest on this is that the president was asked about the arrest of two Americans in Venezuela. Trump said he did not know much about it. Quote, if I wanted to go into Venezuela, I wouldn't make a secret about it. Adding that this was not a good attack. I wouldn't send a small little group. He said it would be called an invasion. Jen, what is the context here? Why would the Venezuelan government even suspect the U.S. of trying to lead a coup?
Well, you know, ever since Juan Guaido, who's the head of the parliament, declared himself the rightful president of Venezuela following, what he and a lot of international observers say was a rigged election, the United States and many other countries, including many European allies, have declared support for Juan Guaido. The U.S. Trump administration has made no secret whatsoever of the fact that they are trying to topple Maduro and to install Juan Guaido. Trump has mused openly about potentially sending troops into Venezuela, at one point surprising his then national security advisor, General McMaster. So he's mused about this before. You know, there's also the fact that the U.S. has a not so great record of supporting coups in Latin America. And what's interesting here, though, is that, you know, unfortunately, Maduro for a long time has maintained that the CIA is behind everything. The CIA is coming for him. And he has used that to stay in power and cling to power and say that, you know, we are fighting against these Yankee imperialists and pushing back on this. And unfortunately, you know, he is now able to use a very real, albeit slapdash and Keystone Cops-esque attempt to actually do that, to further that narrative. And you know, I looked into this this gentleman, Jordan Goudreau, who led this operation, and he has a bit of a history of trying to maybe oversell his capabilities. Before he decided to topple governments, he started his company, Silvercorp USA, basically to sell to parents who are worried about their kids being killed in school shootings, an $8.99 a month subscription to basically having counterterrorism agents put in schools to pose as gym teachers and shop teachers to try to get intel and stop school shootings. He literally pitched this at a conference. So this gentleman has a bit of a history of being a bit of a con man, I would say.
In the minute that we have left, David, is it fair to think that some of these things are occurring because tensions are so high worldwide about COVID-19? Is it sort of upping the stakes diplomatically?
I don't know. Look, I'm British, and I remember the 80s, we had a number of sort of former British special forces guys trying to have coups in Africa and getting arrested when their guns were kind of impounded at the airport and things. I think there are chances. There are bad governments, and chances will sometimes try and take money to topple bad governments. I think that's probably what this was.
Jessica, would you agree, or do you think there's a connection with sort of the tensions globally?
I mean, I think this is just, you know, hugely embarrassing for the U.S. as well. I mean, whether or not they like it, these are sort of former American special operators, you know, some of the most admired forces in the world. And now they're going to have to get them back. And, you know, and Maduro is going to use them as a chip. And it just looks sort of incredibly embarrassing at this point.
Jennifer, last word on this?
You know, honestly, I think the person behind this, I think in some ways really wanted to capitalize on the Trump administration's very real eagerness to get rid of Maduro and maybe went a little overboard in thinking he would have support. And when that support didn't materialize, they ended up in essentially what Jessica said was two canoes with 14 rifles.
My thanks this week to Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor for Vox, from The Wall Street Journal, Jessica Donati, and David Rennie from The Economist. Thanks so much to all of you. Before we go, though, for weeks now, we have been making time at the end of every show for your acts of kindness. Today's story comes from Janelle in Gulf Shores, Alabama.
I am a sand sculptor and was down on the beach sand sculpting yesterday, making a beautiful castle. And these three teenage girls stopped by and were watching me and were really nice and reserved. And then about an hour and a half later, they got up to walk away and handed me three little notes that they had drawn words of encouragement and had drawn at my castle, their renditions. So it was really, really cute and meant a lot to me. I am down there sculpting because most of our events have been canceled, of course. So hoping to bring a little bit of joy to everybody. And in return, I got a little bit of joy back.
Thank you so much to Janelle for that. Sometimes it's the small things, right? If you have an act of kindness to share, we would love to hear from you. Our number is 855-236-1212. WenA's socially distant senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. I Zoom with them every Friday from my home studio in my bunker. Our sound engineer and designer, Jake Cherry, is my other Zoom buddy. Matthew Simonson produces our podcast. They're all part of an incredible team who helped make all of this happen. This program comes to you from my house and WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend. Stay safe, and thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.